NARIP is your record industry knowledge network.
My name is Beth Moore. I am the executive director of the Atlanta chapter of the National Association of Record Industry Professionals. We are a worldwide organization with about 100,000 subscribers. We have about 1,000 of those right here in the Atlanta area. And we do these monthly educational panels about the music industry because some of this stuff you really can't find in books. You have to pick people's brains like these gentlemen here to find out really what's going on. And that's really what we try to focus on. And through that process, you know, people can learn and advance their own careers. We're going to go ahead and just jump right in. Would you guys mind just taking a few minutes to give us maybe like a three-minute biopic on who you are, how you got to become a manager, and how you got to be with Red Light? And Sterling, would you like to begin?
Sure.
Hello, everybody. My name's Sterling Bacon. I got into management in 1998. I was a musician for years. The long time that's what I wanted to do with my life was play and record music and get on stage, and it didn't go so well. About my fourth year living in the back of a van with a band in Colorado, I decided it wasn't quite for me. Grew up in Atlanta, came back here in, I think it was 96, and bounced around to I was at a recording studio and a label, and got into management just because music kind of makes my world go around, and I always felt like management is gives you the most hands-on point of access with an artist to genuinely do something for their career. And got hooked up with Charlie in 1998, and been doing it ever since. And as far as becoming part of Red Light, Charlie can tell you more about that, but we became part of the Red Light family just over a year ago. And pardon my cough drop, I'm getting over a sore throat. I hope it doesn't rattle around in the mic too much.
Thanks.
My name is Charlie Brusco. I started in the music business back when dinosaurs were walking the face of the earth. I started professionally in the music business probably in like 1973. I was in a band when I was in high school. The band came to me one day and told me they had bad news for me and good news for me. They told me I couldn't sing. That I didn't sing on key, so I couldn't be the singer anymore, but that I booked all the shows, so they wanted me to keep booking the band. So I continued doing that, and then I went away to college, and I went to work for a company in Cleveland that was called Belkin Productions, which little did I know while I was in going to school that was going to set the tone for the rest of my career, because this is at the time when live... live music was moving from like the Dick Clark, for any of those of you who know who he was, Dick Clark Caravan of Stars that they used to do where there was 9 or 10 acts or 12 acts on a show to where that Bill Graham was starting to do the shows at the Fillmore East with 3 acts on the shows, and he was doing the shows at Winterland, and there was a network of little ballrooms that were all around the United States that bands were coming over from England, and they were playing their way up the bill. In other words, Led Zeppelin, the first time that they came to America, and maybe the first time that I saw them, they were an opening act on a show. Jimi Hendrix opened up for the Beatles when I saw him one time. But at the time, there was a company in Cleveland that was called Belkin Productions, and they were kind of like the stop on the New York, Boston, New York, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Chicago, then worked their way to the West Coast, and there were all these ballrooms and small theaters that all of a sudden there were actually artists playing and people were paying attention to what production should be like and actually were able to hear the bands singing and everything like that. And the company that I was working for, while I was going to college, and they actually were not only a promoter, but they had artists that they also managed. That's not so... There's still a little bit of that going on today, but back then that was kind of how things were. So I never thought that there was any difference between really being a manager and being a promoter. And probably through most of my career, I've bounced back and forth between either being a promoter and a manager at the same time or just being one or the other, depending upon whether I was burned out on listening to acts stories or if I was burned out on paying them. So I went back and forth from that. And then I graduated from college. I went to Tampa, Florida. As luck would have it, the first night that I was in Tampa, Florida, I went to the University of South Florida to see a band play on the hill there. They'd just come back from Colorado, playing some shows out there. And the band was called The Outlaws. I talked to the guys the next day. I signed them. 4 months later, I got Clive Davis to come see them play. Clive Davis signed the band. They were the first rock band signed to his new label, Arista. And we were off and running. 4 years later, we were headlining Madison Square Garden. And during those 4 years, I kind of found out what you're supposed to do or what you're not supposed to do as a manager. And then I went back and forth between managing for a while and promoting concerts for a while. Some of you may have attended shows here in Atlanta that was either a company called Twin Lion Productions or a company called Presco Bar Presents. We did all the Bon Jovi shows in the Southeast. We did all the REM shows in the Southeast. We did U2. We did Sting. I did that for maybe 10 years or something like that. Decided that I didn't want to put up with those people anymore. Went back into management. I reformed Lynyrd Skynyrd in 1987. That turned into a band that was going to do 30 shows and bring back to the attention of the plane crash and everything like that. And 10 years after the plane crashed, and we turned that into a career. I managed them for 16 years. In 1996, I put Styx back together, kind of a little bit of the same thing as Skynyrd, except for there was no plane crash. We started touring, and also I went back into promoting, but I went into promoting as a national tour promoter, and we did Barry Manilow tour of theaters. The highlights of that stuff, the Manilow Tour of Theaters. We did all the David Copperfield shows. We did the first Fleetwood Mac reunion tour. And we did the Janet Jackson Velvet Rope tour, which is still her biggest tour ever. And we did those nationwide. We promoted them from coast to coast, and we bought the whole tours when we bought them. And then in 2000, I went back into total management, just using with Styx and a number of other acts that we managed during those years. We managed Bad Company, we managed Peter Frampton, we managed John Waite, we managed Michael Bolton, a bunch of other artists. And then in July of 2011. I had a meeting with somebody. The next thing I know, I got a call from Corin Capshaw from Red Light Management, and Corin asked us to go into business with Red Light. And in the beginning of last year, we formed a partnership with Red Light, and we're the Red Light Atlanta office. And for those of you that don't know who Red Light is, Red Light's a management company that manages, I think someone told me today, 220 acts, because we didn't know, and there was a question about how many acts we managed. And we managed, I think, 220 acts. There's about 80 managers involved in the company. There's about 140 people that work for the company. There's offices in Atlanta, New York, multiple offices in Nashville, Charlottesville, Virginia, Los Angeles, New York, London, Denver, Chicago, we're everywhere. We manage collectively. The highlights are the first artist they ever had was Dave Matthews Band. They still have them. Fish, Tim McGraw, Faith Hill, Luke Bryan, Alicia Keys, Alabama Shakes, and on and on. That's what brought us here.
Well, thank you. My next question for you is, can you please lead us through a typical day at the office for you guys?
There's no typical day at our office, that I can tell you.
Yeah, that's part of the beauty of what we do. No, we can't. It's different every day. It's different for every act. It's different for, you know, you might be dealing. I mean, for example, right now we have a we have 14 cities going on sale with a tour we've got going on in the spring that's happening this weekend. So this week has been, the last 2 weeks have been, we're up to our eyeballs in marketing plans and promotional proposals from radio stations and paid advertising grids and fan club pre-sales and you know, ticket holds with box offices and all the things you have to do to get a show up and running. You know, tomorrow it might be the start of a new PR initiative or a social media initiative. We've got a client that we're about to scrap their website and reface their social media. And so it's all of that A to Z. We've got a client that needs remixes on some songs. And so we're talking to different engineers and mixers and producers about finding the right guy to remix them. You know, sometimes it's consoling somebody because their girlfriend dumped them when they were, you know, in a van between Roanoke and you know, Charlottesville. It's
at least the routing was good.
Yeah. but it is different every day, and that's part of what I think is so great about it. It's one of the things I love about management. You're so hands-on in every single thing that your artists are doing. You're not just booking the shows. You're not you're not just dealing with the live side. If you're a promoter, you're not just dealing with record releases. It's all of it. And sometimes that's overwhelming, but it keeps it interesting. And it means you got to know something about everything. You don't have to know everything. And it's funny. I was reading in one of Doc McGee's quotes in here about one of his biggest regrets was not knowing when to admit he didn't know the answer or something like that. It's impossible to know everything, but in management, it's – you got to know something about everything or at least know who to ask because we're dealing with all of it. So, but the shorter answer to your question would have just been no.
Yeah, today we signed a magic act. We signed an illusion show. So I went to L.A. last week and met with the people that have the show, and it's one of the Blackstone family he was one of the main magicians out there for a long, long time, and they came to us with a proposal for us to basically manage the lions and tigers and the, you know, people that are going to be making stuff disappear, and the show plays at performing arts centers and casinos and all that kind of stuff, and it's no different. But that, with one thing that the guy that owns the show promised me was, is that the artist doesn't call us at 3 o'clock in the morning and tell us that they can't do the show the next day because they're too fucked up.
Well, on that note, I would like a show of hands. How many people here consider themselves a manager? All right.
So I notice we didn't raise our hands.
Well, that's about maybe half the room or so. And I manage a band as well. So to all of us young managers in the audience, what's your best advice on getting started and how to really start your reputation off right?
I would rethink the whole thing. I would, because quite frankly, and Sterling will have a different opinion of this, but I'm the soothsayer of doom, because I am convinced that when all of my proteges, and this is the only way that I can think of it, because I want to be vain and stuff like that, but when the Stones and Bruce Springsteen and Fleetwood Mac and all these people decide to retire, all within probably an 8 or 10 year period of time, when I look backwards, I don't see the artist that can keep the amphitheaters and Live Nation and AEG and all these people in business. I don't see enough headliners being built. And there's not the same kind of system to build headliners as there was when I was growing up, because headliners were built when I was growing up because people listened to the radio and they liked what they hear. You can't listen to the radio anymore because there's nothing on it. And I don't believe, and, you know, I'll be dead when you can all prove me wrong, but I don't believe that artists are built by YouTube and all the other crap that there is out there online. I think that the way the live business has been built, and that's all that's left, the way the live business has been built, it's been built on artists being people seeing artists live and becoming fans of theirs and following them and following them and following them. And the younger kids that I see are not as interested in who made a record, who's on the record, a band's whole record as I was. They're more interested in games and, you know, war things whatever Game Boys or shit they're playing with. That kind of stuff has taken away from what build live music. And the live entertainers that are out there that can still deliver, most of them are going to die in the next 20 years.
All right, good night. let's shut it down. Yeah, I do have a different perspective. I have to. Really, a lot of what Charlie's saying is true. I think, and I don't want to get way off topic and lost on some tangent. I can ramble about this one, but I think that we're in a period in this business where people like to say the old model's dead. The old model's not dead. The old model's dying, and it's a much slower death than I think anyone anticipated, and it's hanging on by tooth and nail. And what's happening is that this old model is still there, and despite popular belief, it's still pretty relevant in a lot of areas. And there's all this amazing – I wouldn't say there is a quote-unquote new model. There are all these amazing tools available to us now. Obviously, the world has changed a hell of a lot in the last 15 years, let alone the last 3-4 years in terms of technology and how it's affected culture and arts and everything. But – have you guys read who's read the book The Future of Music? All right.
Who's it by?
Gerd Leonard and there's a co-author, a professor from Berkeley. I'm blanking on his name. Gerd Leonard had a great quote recently, and to paraphrase it, he said, "The old's dying, the new cannot be reborn or cannot be birthed, so to speak, and in the interim, we're kind of screwed." Because you have this old guard that is fighting and kicking and clawing, and until the old really dies, we can't really start to do business in a new world. And there's evidence of that everywhere. And I think what happens is that in the meantime, we focus a lot on the wrong things. We like to cry about the royalty rate on a stream from Spotify. It's terrible. Part of the reason it's so terrible is because they can't structure a licensing deal to allow them. It's a perfect example. I was saying this to someone in the lobby earlier. You look at a company like Netflix. Netflix streaming is struggling to get content. The reason they're struggling is that nobody wants to move away from the ownership and download model because they make so much more money. If you go to iTunes and download the movie or an MP3 or rent it for 72 hours and pay $6 or whatever it is, everybody makes so much more money than if you stream it from Netflix. Same thing holds true with buying music on iTunes versus Spotify. Part of the reason that's happening is that there is so much of this old model still in place that is hanging on. And personally, I think probably what has to happen is a whole lot of copyright law has to be rewritten to give us a foundation to be able to structure the kind of deals that right now we cannot. Anyway, I know I'm getting off topic, but my point is that all of what Charlie just said is true, but we have to get through this period of transition. Our biggest problem in this business is not how do I monetize, how do I make money. The biggest problem, in my opinion, the biggest problem we have is how do you go out and create the kind of fan bases that a band like the Outlaws could do, you know, nearly 40 years ago, 45 years ago, however long, or bands like Radiohead 20 years ago. How do you develop that kind of a relationship with a fan base, with a consumer who is so lost in everything that we're all lost in these days? Because if you can reach those people and create a sense of value, if you can develop a trust with an audience and turn them into fans, there are ways to monetize it. Maybe it's tough right now, but eventually we're going to come out of this period of transition. And when we do, the people that know how to develop those kinds of relationships with a fan are going to find ways to make money. It may not be the money that it used to be. It won't be. But there's – so we're going to come out of this period, and the biggest challenge, I think, is again, it's that development. It's creating that fan base and nurturing that fan base and creating that value. And in the meantime, we've got to survive. There's a lot more ugliness we got to survive before we're going to get to a period where the climate of this business is really such that people can truly make money.
And what I was saying was where I'm coming from. Where you guys are at and where he's at, you've got to have more people that are into it like he is. That's gonna be the thing that will, and those of you that are going to decide to do this for a living, that's what you're going to have to do. You're going to have to, just like I did when I was 17 or 18 years old, I decided, I mean, the honest to God's truth is I got into the business because I didn't want to work in a restaurant that my father owned, and this was a good way to meet chicks and to do drugs. So that was the easiest way to progress into all of those things and actually act like you had a real job, which that and I come from an era of an intense amount of entrepreneurs and musicians that were extremely talented from both America and from England, that all kind of hit together at the same time with the same kind of idealism and what they wanted. And I think that right now the biggest problem is that there's too much of the Kardashians and the Housewives of Beverly Hills, and they're too busy making these people who have absolutely no talent into stars and throwing money at them like it's water, when there's artists out there that are extremely talented, but there's no way to get them out there because they're not train wrecks. They're actually talented musicians and people that can do stuff. And I think that at some point there will be a shift back to that. But right now, it's the youth and it's the way that things are being thrown out there, you know, for 15 minutes. Actually, I don't even believe it's 15 minutes of fame anymore. I think you only get 10 minutes. I think the 15 minute thing is passed us by. But that's the thing. You've got to be able to take your artist and keep your, especially if you're looking to, I've had artists that have careers. I don't have artists that have hits. Not interested in hits. I know hits bring a lot of money and everything like that, but they actually bring very little, in my world, they bring very little satisfaction. You've got to be able to get people to pay attention to your artist, if you have them, that are really talented. And you got to be able to just put your everything you have into it, because they have to put everything they have into it, and you have to put everything into it, and your chances that it's going to actually happen, you've got to understand you would be better to learn how to gamble and go to Vegas and gamble the money and see if you could win the money that way than in the business. But those that have a, you know, the Scooter Braun's of the world that go in and find an artist, and they find an artist that's too young to begin with, and they don't, instead of throwing him out there at 14 years old, they hone him in and they do the stuff that he's supposed to do to make him come out at 16 or 17 years old, and all of a sudden build a career for an artist. That's a marriage between an artist that could not be denied and a manager that could not be denied. And quite frankly, I'm not a Justin Bieber fan at all, and I actually thought that Bieber would fall off the map as his audience got a little bit older. But I got to tell you something. I think this kid could end up like Justin Timberlake. I think he could have a career because he's been well done, and he puts on a great show, and his audience will hopefully grow with him. That's the one thing you got to worry about if you're interested, if you're doing teen stuff, that your artist outgrows the fans get older and they can't be involved with it anymore because it was something they liked when they were young.
I'm going to take a quick break. Can you guys make more room for some of the folks at the door so maybe they can sit on the ledge there? Because I want you guys to make sure that you can see and you're comfortable. So come on down. You can take a seat on the ledge, or maybe Big O can go get us more chairs. Okay, cool. You guys good? Well, given the topic of artist development, if the record labels aren't doing it anymore, or if they're making the wrong choices, do you think that there's room there for management companies to start developing new artists? And do you guys do that at all?
To a degree, but I think the reality is, in this day and age, it is so incumbent on the artist to do so much more than they used to have to do. Record companies still spend boatloads of money on artists. It's just in different places, and it's on fewer artists. And by the time most of those artists are signing deals, they're either ready for, you know, network television and the whole nine yards, or they're very close to it. I mean, we get asked all the time, when is an act ready for management? And it's usually never as soon as the artist thinks it is, and it's because there is so much that you have to do on your own as an artist before somebody can help you. And it's not that it's not because we're lazy or we don't want to spend the time or whatever. It's because that's how competitive it is these days. And if you, as an artist, can't kind of, you know, understand first that you're a business, it may be art, but it is a business. And do all of the things beyond just writing good songs and making sure your live show is great. There's so much more you have to do. So I think so much more falls on their shoulders. There is – that's not to say that we don't get involved in the process, because we do. But usually by the time we're working with an artist, it becomes more of a – probably more of a fine-tuning process than a true development process. There are exceptions, and I could probably name some acts on the Red Light roster that are exceptions to this rule. But by and large, it's we can't get involved with an artist until an artist has done absolutely every single thing they can do for them for themselves first.
But I will also say that 10 years ago or 8 years ago or something like that, there weren't these mega management conglomerations. Irving's out now, but when Azoff was rolling up all the stuff that he was doing with Live Nation and Frontline Management and all that stuff, that he was, him and Korn were both doing it kind of at the same time. But before that, I mean, managements that had management offices, most of them were a couple of guys that were good managers, and they had a few assistants, and they did what they did, and they managed the act, and they got the tours together, and they got the records done with a record company and all that stuff. I mean, Red Light is actually, and well, I'm not going to say anything about anybody else, but Red Light in particular, Red Light has replaced every situation that an artist needs from a record company, because number one, we have two record companies that are part of Red Light Management. And the other thing is that a lot of our acts are independent on independent labels or put their records out themselves. And it's gotten to the point that even like a Dave Matthews Band who releases their records through RCA Records, the records are worked by our promotion, our Red Light Management radio promotion staff. They direct the label staff how to work the record. We have in-house marketing people. We have in-house everybody, but it depends on at what level the artist is, whether how much access they get to all that stuff. Because when you have artists that put out still put out music that sells like Alicia does or Dave Matthews does or Tim and Faith do or Luke Bryan does. I mean, any of those artists. When they have something coming up, everybody's jumping up and down to make sure that their stuff's being done. At the same time, we have acts that are developing at radio that may think they should be getting more attention, but they're getting the attention that they should get. But they look at what's being done for some of the other artists, and they go like, oh well, why isn't that happening for me? Well, it's because that's not the level that you're on. It costs money to do what has to be done out there for promoting and marketing records and everything like that. And quite frankly, artists like Tim McGraw and Dave Matthews and Alicia Keys and them, they pony up their own money. They're not looking for somebody else, where most artists are looking for the record company to back their play. These artists back their own plays. These artists are interested in, they will pay for everything that goes on as long as they get the lion's share of what the money is that's coming back in from however the records are being distributed. And that's where a lot of things are moving to, and that's why you're seeing so many management companies kind of bond together, because an individual management company can't afford to have all of that infrastructure. But in today's world, if you're reliant on either the record company out there or the publishing company or anything like that to get your thing done for you, then you're at their mercy. You're still going to be in line there with their artist, because labels have X amount of artists and releases coming out, and whether no artist wants to hear that the new Aerosmith records is more important than their record. But quite frankly, it's like Sterling said, it's a business, and if you're there's a pecking order for everything in the world. I mean, that's what it is.
Very good. Well, I know you guys work with a lot of already established artists, people whose names we all recognize. But maybe thinking back on the days when you were first starting out and working with startup artists, what were some of the criteria that you would consider about whether to hire or sign a band?
For me, it has always started and stopped with seeing a band on stage live. I've never been a manager that's been one that's an A&R manager that listens to songs. I have anywhere from 10 to 100 people that I can send various stages of how a song's either been finished or developed or needs remixed or anything like that. I send it to somebody that's what they do for a living. That's what they do. They listen to stuff and they know. I'm not a radio or a record or an airplay kind of manager. I got to know that a band can absolutely destroy 10,000 people on a stage in front of a crowd, because I always thought, and I always still think, that if they can do that, the song will come at some point. Either they'll write it or somebody's going to see this band and go like, wow, I saw them open up for the Stones and they were amazing and they're missing a song, and I know here's a song. Songs come around all, and it's got, I mean, with as big as Nashville has gotten, and as homogenized as that situation is with writers writing songs for other people, I mean, you know, the stuff that comes out of Nashville, 90% of it is written by, you know, 25 people. And it's not the guys that you're hearing sing the song. So, you know, to find a song for somebody in today's day and age is not that big of a deal. My opinion is, though, that the great songs have come from the acts that are great live on stage and them writing something that they know connects with the people that are out there.
Yeah, I just add to that, you know, obviously, as Charlie said, it's that something special, getting on stage. And beyond that, work ethic is a big one. It's amazing how often we meet artists who, from day one, have a sense of entitlement. I wrote a song that I think is great, and you owe me somehow. The world owes me, and I don't want to go near that, because it's not how it works. Work ethic and patience, too. I don't know how many of you guys watched the Grammys the other night, but I thought it was great when Nate, the singer from Fun, when they're accepting their Grammy for Best New Artist, said, "We've been around for 12 years, and they may fit the criteria for that award of New Artist." But that's a typical story. It's not an anomaly. That's
Jason Aldean, 10 years before he actually really started the break.
So, you know, work ethic and patience. First, they got to be great, as Charlie said. Beyond that, they've back to what I was saying about the amount of work an artist has to do. We got to know they can do it, and know that they're in it for the long haul, and know that if in 6 months they feel like things aren't going the way they want, that it's not the end of the road.
Have you ever had to drop a client for reasons other than money? Like they weren't bringing in enough?
Yes.
You don't have to give names.
Luther Vandross. I dropped Luther because Luther was so unhappy and so miserable in his own life that he couldn't, that he was horrible to anybody that was around him. And he would, and I put together the single biggest tour for him that he walked home with the most amount of money. Now, the reason that he walked home with the most amount of money is because I wouldn't let him go into every store that he went by and buy everything that was in the store with the tour proceeds. So he went home with all kinds of money, and he was pissed off about the whole thing, and he made a couple of comments, and I walked in, and I actually walked into the place that he was playing that night, which was the Hard Rock in Las Vegas, and I had it on my mind that I was going to walk up to him, and I was just going to knock him on his ass, because that's kind of like the way I do things. And for whatever reason, I didn't go back to see him before the show, and the minute that he started singing, I turned to my wife and I said, "Well, I can't hit him now because I can't hit somebody that sings like that. There's just no way." So I just went back and quietly said to him, "Send me my check and let's part company now." And that's the way it went.
Sometimes too, it's not as cool as trying to beat up Luther Vandross, but sometimes you've got the truth is that not every manager is a fit for every artist. It's called personal management for a reason, and there is a personal relationship. And just like in, you know, you don't click with everybody, and the same is true in our business. And sometimes, obviously, you try to assess that before you go into business with somebody, but sometimes it takes time for those things to come out. And sometimes you get down the road with somebody and you discover, you know what, the way we want to go, we might have the same goal, but the way we want to go about it is not a fit. And there's a lot of reasons.
Yeah, we had a great relationship with Michael Bolton, and it just came to a point where Michael's touring costs that he had being on the road were so excessive that he basically didn't have any money to pay publicity people, management, anything like that, and we just kind of like came to a parting of the ways and everything like that. And I still hear from Michael, you know, once a month or something like that, or once every 6 weeks, I'll get a email from him telling me what he's doing and how things are going, and we've remained friends. You know, John Bon Jovi, who I promoted for all the years here in Atlanta and everything like that, and he took a deal for $100 million from AEG to do a tour, and I got cut out of being the tour anymore. And the only thing that did for me is that now anytime I go out to dinner or go somewhere with John, he picks up the check instead of me. So we remained friends. I like to, when if there's a parting, unless there's something really bad that goes on, I mean, I've tried to remain friends with my artist even if we leave, because quite frankly, you never know when they're going to come back around. I mean, I got fired by Lynyrd Skynyrd 4 times. All right, I managed them. They would leave, then they would go like, "Oh, we can't stand this guy." They went to Bill Graham for a while, and they came back from Bill, and were like, "You know, we want you back." It's that stuff just happens. I mean, there's things that go on, and it's no different than a relationship with people that, you know, something can happen and seems like you're never going to talk to that person again, and then 6 months later, you can't remember why you're not talking to them. That stuff happens. It happens in this business.
Cool. Well, let's stay on some of these juicy topics. I've got a good one for y'all.
Oh, boy.
I would like to know what has been your biggest success and your biggest failure? And you can pick which one to start with.
Okay. We just list all the failures?
You can do that, too. Anything that we can learn from, or just get a peek inside y'all's heads.
I'll throw a success out there, and this is really more Charlie's credit, but since he hasn't thought of it yet. Volunteers for America. And this kind of gets outside it doesn't get outside the scope of management, but in after 9/11, Tommy Shaw from Styx, I'm days after, called Charlie up and said, "We got to do something." Was it October, like October 20 and 21, so 5 weeks after 9/11, we put on 2 concerts, one in Atlanta and one in Dallas, that raised $900,000 for the Port Authority Police Department. And it was the most, in hindsight, looking at what got pulled off in an incredibly short amount of time, it still makes my head spin. You know, we, Charlie primarily, but and the band members too, started calling, you know, the guys in other classic rock bands, Journey and Bad Company and Peter Frampton and Skynyrd, and saying, will you guys help? And I mean, you know,
and everybody did it for free.
For everybody that remembers that feeling after 9/11, and especially when it's so fresh, everybody said, yeah, what can I do? You know, the buildings came to us for free. We had people finding ways to get flights and hotels and the whole nine yards. And I'll never forget. I'm really telling Charlie's story here, but to his credit, we were looking for a place to donate the money. And, you know, the NYPD got a lot of press because they lost a staggering number of guys, as did the fire department. The Port Authority wasn't getting talked about very much, and they lost they're a much smaller force. And in terms of percentage-wise, they lost just a shocking percentage of their force, and they weren't getting any help. So we connected with the Port Authority Police Department, and I'll never forget, they sent two officers down, both of whom were like the most immense. I mean, the shorter one was 6'10". I'll never forget seeing those guys backstage. This was down at Lakewood, and just sort of like being in awe just at their size, and they're in their dress blues. And this is, remember, this is 5 weeks after 9/11, and so the mood is still, everybody's dazed. And so all these bands who are accustomed to headliner status and getting things done a certain way are sharing production and sharing backline and doing short sets, and the crew is working for free, and all of these people are pitching in. And there's 19,000 people in that building. And I'll never forget, Drew Carey was emceeing the show. And about midway through, I'd walked out and was standing by the mix console, and he brought those Port Authority cops out on stage. And there was just a black backdrop with an American flag. And 19,000 people stood up and lost their minds. And the USA chant broke out. And I'll admit, every now and then, in other circumstances, that might have felt corny. But in that moment after 9/11, it was the most inspiring thing ever. And these 2 7-foot cops stood up there and cried. And then we did it again the next night in Dallas. But that was without a doubt. And that was 12 years ago. But to this day, I don't know that anything will ever top that. I was proud to have been a part of it. And quick, I won't get into the whole story, but quick side note. We worked 12 and 13 and 14-hour days trying to get ready for that. And our office got robbed 10 days before. Mm-hmm. Every computer, every bit of information we had.
Everybody's flights.
And this was long enough ago that we didn't all have smartphones and cloud backup, and we lost every single bit of information that we had to put together these two huge events. But you know, we got it back together, and I'll be proud of that for as long as I live. It was amazing.
Very cool.
The highlights, or I really don't have one. There's first one's probably getting the Outlaws signed to Clive Davis. That was huge. The first time the Outlaws headlined Madison Square Garden, there's just something about walking on a stage where the stagehands are getting paid more than the artist, because the stagehand bills are so high in New York City that I was kind of shocked when I saw that. But still having your artist walk on that stage and having playing the Garden is still a very, very special moment for any band the first time they do it. Putting Lynyrd Skynyrd back together in 1987, those 32 shows were completely magical. I somehow stumbled into an award that Naris gave me, where John Bon Jovi flew in from New York and gave me the award, and I was honored with the B-52s, Usher, and Coretta Scott King. And
at the Hall of Fame, right? Georgia Music.
No, that was the Naris.
Oh, okay.
That was Naris. It was called the Naris. At the time, it was called the Naris Heroes Award. And to see your name next to Coretta Scott King for anything, to me was just amazing. Then I was inducted into the then Putting Sticks Back Together. The Janet Jackson Velvet Rope tour was just to work with someone as professional as Janet is, and to work with Roger Davies, who managed her, and we did it for like we worked on that tour for like four. The tour actually lasted like 4 months, and it was just amazing. The last night we did the stadium in Hawaii, and to watch her walk out on stage, and though it was our last show with that band, was just amazing. Putting Sticks Back Together in 96, while I was on my honeymoon, actually, and not supposed to be working, and that started that first phase of that marriage off really well. And then being inducted into the Georgia Music Hall of Fame, that was just a couple of years ago. That was really big. But the thing is that there's also little things that go on that kind of, you know, just are special moments when you just see a band, you know, and you get excited about a band, and sometimes that band doesn't end up being anything. But those first couple of times that you see them, they blow you away. You work for years and years and years to try and break them, and it doesn't happen. And then, because we had a band for a while that was called the Freddie Jones Band, that I thought was going to be the somewhere between the Allman Brothers and Widespread Panic, and we did everything right. We got them on the right stuff, and they got radio airplay and everything like that, but it just never got to that next stage. And that band, I still, if they get together and they play somewhere, I try and make it to go see them play wherever they play. As far as stuff that was a setback, I don't even remember any. I mean, I'm sure they're there, but I don't tend to think about things that didn't work. I tend to think about the ones that do.
Sterling?
Yeah, I don't know that I'd point to specific moments as failures. I think sometimes you look back on a relationship with an artist and you can pinpoint some bigger picture things that didn't go right. You know, I can think of times when I've let kind of the end goal, the vision, the picture of that end goal get clouded by a lot of things. Sometimes it's, sometimes you're dealing with pretty strong personalities in this business. And part of our job is helping people who have what they think is a vision of the right thing understand that in this business, maybe it's not going to work quite like that. And so you have to do certain things and shift some, maybe not the goal, but the way you achieve it. And I can think of times when it's when you're dealing with strong personalities, sometimes that, you know, the path you're taking can get clouded by the wrong things. So I don't know that I could say, hey, this specific thing was a failure. But we make mistakes every day, just like everybody does. And obviously, like anything, you try to look at them and figure out why you did them and not do them again.
Okay. Well, before we take a break, I would like to talk about the numbers. Everybody's always curious to talk about the numbers. So I'm not asking for y'all to tell us how much you make in a year unless you want to. I guess I'm curious to start out with maybe what is how is an artist's gross revenues broken down as far as, you know, merchandising, record sales, endorsements, personal appearances? Can you take maybe one artist and break down the numbers for us? It can be a fictional artist if you don't want to name him.
Okay, I'll name a fictional artist, John Bon Jovi. All right? Because Johnny and I were discussing this within the last 6 months or a year in a non-football conversation, which we usually talk football, but we were talking about his gross income, and he was talking about the fact that he has a record deal that had one record left on it, and he was getting, for sake of argument, let's say he was getting $10 million for that last record. And I said, oh, because the normal reaction would be from a manager, oh, you're out of that deal, great. Right? And John said, Yeah, he goes, actually, that the bad news is he goes, I don't know that anybody else in these days in this climate would pay $10 million for a worldwide record by me or anybody else right now, which is probably true. So then you do so that, and then we were talking about his website is a very, very active website. It sells tickets, sells everything. So he's a mastermind of he's a step behind Gene Simmons, and I'll put my name on anything. And there was he was telling me that his online business had grown from, well, let's say, $2 million 3 years ago to, after the last tour, they added it up, and it was like $12 million. So here you got an album, let's say, for $10 million, and let's say merchandise money that's in the $10 or $15 million range or anything like that, and that's like, wow. Well, yeah, except for his touring money was approaching $200 million. So now, in the old days, unless you were a really big act like a Bon Jovi or somebody like that, you're maybe 10% of your money came in from your record company sales and everything like that, unless you were a gigantic pop artist. But if you were a touring artist, probably 10% of your money came in from that. 10% of your money came in from merchandise, and the rest of the money came in from your live appearances. But back then, the monies were like, if you made a couple of million dollars off of your record sales and a couple of million dollars off of your merchandise, and you had a tour that did $15 million, before Irving made the Eagles tickets $100, which I think was like 98 or 97, around that area, where the first Hell Freezes Over tour. Before that happened, that was big money for an artist. When that happened, everybody kept finding out that how much money the scalpers were making off of the artist, because and in some cases the artists were the scalpers, and in some cases the managers were the scalpers, and in some cases the promoters were the scalpers. But all that money was never making it into the pot at the end of the night. That money was disappearing off the plate. People were paying for those tickets, but the money was going to the broker, and the broker had a deal to get those tickets with somebody, and that money was basically disappearing. Now, with the advent of VIP tickets that are run by either Ticketmaster, or all the money is showing back up in the growth. Well, there is still ticket brokers out there, but people, I mean, we were under for probably from 1985 to 2000, we undervalued every live ticket that was sold. Because for every ticket that they for the people that were paying $17.50 a ticket, I remember when I was promoting, the biggest argument I ever got into with Bill Graham was we were going to do the Amnesty International show here at the Omni, and it was Sting, U2, Lou Reed, Bryan Adams. I mean, it was a stacked show. And Alex Cooley were on a conference call together, and Bill brought up ticket price, and Bill said, "What do you think the ticket price should be?" And I said, $18.50. And Bill said, "You're out of your fucking mind." He said, "The tickets are going to be $35," and I said, "You're out of your mind." I go, "There's never been a concert ticket in Atlanta that's over $20." And he said, "But look at what this show is, and look at where the money's going." And I said, "Doesn't matter. The people won't pay that." Well, they'll pay that. So he made us keep the ticket at $35. We went on sale and we sold 8,000 tickets, which is not good. All right. But back then, that's where the ticket prices were. Go forward now, your average ticket price for a major headliner out there, that's the price on the ticket, not counting VIP tickets or any of that stuff, your average ticket's probably between $135 and $160. But all that money is now going into going into what the proceeds are for the night that is that's split up by the promoter and the artist. So the artist is now finally getting their share of what the money should be for the night.
For comparison, quickly, I'd say, I mean, I'm working with a young act right now that tours, and I'd say end of year, roughly, 80% of the money they see comes from touring, 10 comes from record sales. Actually, no, I take it back, probably about 10 from merch. Less on record sales, because for a lot of developing artists, you're giving away a lot of your music. They do sell it, but they give a lot of it away. So probably about 10 on merch, 5 on sales, and the other 5, a combination of performance royalties, the occasional sync license, things like that.
And can you guys give us an idea of what your management commission is, percentage-wise, or what a healthy range would be?
Standard commission at Red Light Management is 15%. Cool. That doesn't mean that everybody pays that. That means that's what the standard commission is.
And is that more of a gross commission or net?
Gross.
Cool. Okay. Did you have anything to add?
No. I mean, 15% is probably kind of standard across the board. You do see, I mean, you see them from 10 to 20. You do sometimes see net deals, although that's in rare cases. But 15 standard at Red Light and standard at most firms.
Let me see. Let's see what time it is. Okay. Tell you what. Let's go ahead and take a break. I have 8:20 right now. If everybody could be back and in your seats at 8:35, we'll start the Q&A portion. So have your questions ready, guys. Welcome back from the break. Just to let you guys know, we try to wrap up at 9:30. We have to be out of the building before 10 o'clock, but... You might notice a lot of people hang out outside, and you're perfectly welcome to congregate on the sidewalk. But we have to respect SAE, and they've been a gracious host. And Rich, thank you for recording this tonight. Appreciate it.
Rich. Here for Rich.
I'm going to breeze through a couple of more housekeeping points that I glossed over in the beginning. Somebody came up to me during the break and asked how they could be a volunteer. We are always looking for volunteers, you know, people to greet guests at the front door, to do registration, to just generally help events run smoothly, and to the extent that anybody wants to help organize events. You know, we do these educational panels once a month, and we also do networking brunches once a quarter. We already had our one for this quarter in January, but our next one is coming up on April 20th at Silent Sound Studios. We also have another event coming, another educational panel coming up next month on March 13th, and that's going to be a mock negotiation of a publishing deal. And February is the two-for-one month, so if you pre-purchase tickets to these events in February, you get to take advantage of that two-for-one deal. I also want to take a minute to recognize our NARUPS board members. We couldn't do these events without Eric Newcomer, Chloe Peacock, Julie Kessler, who is a volunteer with us, and our newest NARUP board appointee is Tina Dorenzis. And I just wanted to ask Tina if she would like to introduce herself and just say a few words as our newest appointee.
Oh, thank you.
And please do
thank
it at the
you.
Mic.
Yeah, I don't know if you can hear me. Thanks so much. It's been an honor and a pleasure to have been asked to the board. I'm thrilled to be a part of working with a great team of people. NARUP has introduced me to so many music industry professionals. So as Beth said, I really encourage you all, if you want to get around and meet the best of the best, then NARUP or any other music organization is a great way to start. So the pleasure is all mine, and I look forward to working with you all this year. Thanks.
Thank you, Tina. Mm-hmm. Yay! And also, by show of hands, has anybody become a NARUP member this year since 2013 started? Raise your hands. Got a few. Okay, we have a special gift for you in the lobby that we would invite you guys to pick up on your way out. One of our NARUP followers has written a book called How to Manage Pop Artists, and he was nice enough to send us a couple copies, and we thought that was a good way to reward you guys for getting involved, and then also help one of our own members. So so grab one on your way out. It's actually on my next book to read. Okay, so this is the interactive portion of the evening. It can only happen with y'all's participation. So whatever questions you are harboring that these two intelligent men can answer for you about music management, about the music industry, if you want to pry into their personal lives, you know, their answers are up to them, but we invite you to begin asking your questions. And the microphone is right up front. You can start a line. Who wants to go first? All right, go ahead. And please say your name if you want to say, you know, what your role is in the industry so we know a little bit about you. That would be great.
I am Julie Kessler, and I'm graduating from Emory Law in May. I'm interested in entertainment law. I was wondering about the comparison between the music markets in L.A. versus Atlanta as far as getting a start and you know, being managers. Do you send people out to L.A., or do you think they can make it in Atlanta?
You mean artists or people looking to get into the business?
Both.
Well, on the artist side, there's not an easy answer. I know I've never sent anybody to L.A. to get their start for a couple of reasons. You know, I think this depends a lot on what kind of music an artist is trying to do. You know, if you're a rock band and you've got some a network in your local community, you're going to need resources like that to help get you started. I'm a believer in, you know, learning how to, you know, you got to be able to throw a party in your own backyard and have people show up before you can worry about, you know, going too far away from home and doing it. And so in terms of growing an act, this is not a new idea at all. People have been doing it for years, but you start in your hometown and you develop it and you gradually broaden the circle, you know, and reach more and more markets as you go. It's kind of a grassroots approach. Not the right approach for every kind of artist, but sending somebody to another town, it would take some pretty special circumstances to do that. Now, on the business side, if somebody said, where should I be to get a start in this business? You know, it's honestly, it's a little bit of a coin flip. It's there are more jobs there because there's more industry there. Same with New York, same with Nashville. At the same time, it's more competitive. I think that I would say there's also a pretty amazing music community right here in Atlanta that I would encourage people to stay in, and help us grow something in Georgia that has become incredibly cool. You know, in years past, I've worked with acts who lived in very remote areas, one being Redding, California. You can draw a 4-hour radius around Redding, California, and there's about 8 people that live inside that circle. For years, I tried to convince that band to leave Redding, because their network of people was like literally the guy who ran the Harley shop and the guy who ran the one music store in town. And so it's not like there's a pool of resources. That's an example of a band that I said, you guys need to get out of town. You're stuck. I'm not really giving you a good answer, but it really kind of depends on the circumstances and what you're trying to do.
Thank you.
As far as, I can only go from my own experience, and I know of that I can remember 3 different times that I've been offered extremely lucrative deals to pick up my stuff and move to Los Angeles, and I'm still in Atlanta. I would rather be here where I have done my business for 40 years and know the lay of the land and everything like that than to be in the rat race that I think LA is. And I mean, the only place that I could see myself moving out of Atlanta to possibly would be Nashville. And Nashville to me in some ways is similar to Atlanta people wise and everything like that, but it's still totally, you know, that's a, if you're in Nashville or LA and you're in the business, you're going to eat, breathe, and sleep that business 24 hours a day because that's what everybody in those towns do. I like to be able to every now and then turn things off and not be in the music business for, you know, anywhere from 12 to 24 hours. But out there, I just don't think, or in Nashville, I don't think it's possible. Or at least I don't see it with my contemporaries that are in those cities. And if you're in the law business, I would stick with that end.
Sounds good.
Good choice.
All right, who's next? You guys can form a line if you like. Yeah, just step over, people. It's inevitable.
Hello, everyone. DeMarco Freebird here. Just wanted to ask a quick question. I've been here in Atlanta for just about 20 months or something like that, recording music and just meeting and networking around that. And I'm noticing for the style of music that I actually create, which is a combination of rock and pop, it's sort of not really an exact split place or space here in Atlanta. I kind of find it that I'm going to have to kind of invent something in order to perform my own sort of music. So my question to you is, you mentioned something about sort of artists having an old school way of doing things that has not died yet, but you didn't mention like loads of things of what that really consists of versus to people thinking to become famous on YouTube and things like that. So just wondering, a bit curious into what were those sort of things that you were saying that, you know, kind of the old ways that people are finding ways to kind of get themselves seen or introduced into a market that is very tough to introduce yourself into.
Well, I don't think, when I was referring to the things that haven't died yet, it's not so much that those things are being used to introduce new artists to the market. What's happening is that at the mainstream level, whether you are in pop, country, hip-hop, or whatever your format, with the exception of most of the rock formats, the truth is it is still a radio-driven market, and it is still funded by big dollars. Mm-hmm. And we talk a lot about the decline of radio, which and radio's reach has declined.
Right.
We talk a lot about the decline of major labels in particular, and we don't, I mean, now we're down to the big three. I mean, the consolidation is scary. But the reality is, and it doesn't, it's not hard to figure this out if you look at the SoundScan charts and media-based airplay charts. They're still, the mainstream formats are still largely dominated by acts that have the money behind them from major labels to mount radio campaigns that cost millions of dollars.
Right.
And so that's what I was referring to in terms of some of the and then along with all that is the still clinging to this physical distribution model and brick and mortar, which is quickly dying but hasn't died, and how that's sort of transitioning to the ownership model of a download of you know, when you buy an MP3 at iTunes. My feeling is anyway that's going to be gone, at least on a widespread level, at some point when we shift over to subscription. But as at the same time, there are, you know, I mentioned that the rock, I kind of left the rock formats out. One of the things that's happened in recent years is the reemergence of AAA radio, which a few years ago people said was basically cooked. It was done. It was meaningless. And now you have acts like, well, Mumford & Sons is the most notable right now, but bands like the Lumineers, you've got labels like Glass, Alabama Shakes, a red light act that we haven't mentioned. Bands that are emerging from AAA and then crossing over to a mainstream, you know, a much larger audience. And I think that's significant because it's sort of a, it's, to me, it's the most important shift in what's going on in commercial radio in the last few years anyway, because it has brought all this amazing music to the forefront that previously was really considered underground and indie. But, those new tools are, as far as new artists trying to establish themselves in a market, they are vital. You know, you can't be worrying about radio airplay. You can't be worrying about television appearances and things like that and full-blown PR campaigns. And there's all, I'm sure we could all name really cool success stories over the last couple of years of acts that have broken from, I mean, Gangnam Style, for crying out loud. Jesus. But things that have emerged from...
But that's not a business. That's a...
Agreed.
That happens.
Agreed. But acts that have emerged from, you know, something, a piece of content going viral. So anyway, I think the things I was referring to aren't so much the tools for developing new artists. Mm-hmm. They are really the tools that still exist for pushing big artists out to the mainstream that are still very much in play.
I see.
Okay. I'm looking right here at this week's SoundScan, And of the top 10 artists at this week's SoundScan, which will change every week, but out of this top 10, 7 out of the top 10 are funded by major labels. So, and probably if you keep on going down the chart, you're going to find that the ones that are out there making a larger name for themselves that way and touring that way and breaking themselves, the Katy Perrys and the people like that. I mean, Katy Perry probably spent $1 million easily just in video. Mm-hmm. All right. Somebody's advancing that money. When you get into that, there's people that go like, what can it take to, you know, we have artists that come to us, new artists, and you know, some of them have somebody that's got money that their aunt or their uncle or somebody died or wherever the money's coming from, who knows? They got a drug dealer that's a friend. They go, how much money does it take? Well, then you get into the thing of, to break a pop record at radio, you're talking about somebody's going to have $250,000 to $400,000 to break the first single. Mm-hmm. In today's game, you can break the first single, and all you've done is broken a single. Right. I mean, you still got an album that still has to, you know, and now all of a sudden you've got, you've on top of that, you've got all kinds of other things that have to all of a sudden be getting paid for. We've had artists that come in with $50,000, $100,000 to promote their record with them, and we'll tell them, okay, that'll get you to a certain point, but what are you going to do then? Mm-hmm. Because then you're getting out of the minor leagues, and you're moving towards more of the major leagues. And the major leagues have funding. Mm-hmm. And somebody has to have that funding. Now, a lot of times, if you're an indie and you push a record a certain way up, then you're going to get the attention of somebody that's going to come and write a big check. But that's one thing that as far as pop radio is concerned and country radio is concerned, which are the two big radio formats that can help sell records, that's still a money game. That's still somebody's got to be writing big checks. Because the thing is, in the older days, guys could play records on the radio, and all of a sudden it would pick up, and people would go like, "Oh, wow, I heard that record." And then a DJ would hear that record's working, so they'd play the record in another city, and it would build that way. That don't happen anymore. I mean, nowadays it's the game of the promotion guy is getting the record on the radio, and you know, there's one guy here in Atlanta that controls, 81 radio stations. The format, the what gets played on those stations. So if you don't get him, you got a big hole in your radio story.
Have so you, that name,
you're right? So you've got to get it.
I do want to, right? Cumulus Broadcasting, but I do want to add quickly though that if you look at that top 10. On the encouraging side, at least in my eyes, there's two indies in the top 10 right now. Glassnote, which is Mumford & Sons. They also have Phoenix and Givers and a number of other cool bands.
Well-funded.
Daniel Glass comes from a major label background, and they've got outside funding. But funding aside, that first single, I remember hearing the demo of Little Lion Man because they actually released it. I don't have some cool underground connection to it. They released it. But I remember Daniel Glass saying, you know, probably 3 years ago, we're trying to take a band. It initially started at non-com radio and then it went to AAA and now it's pop. But they're trying to take a band with a banjo, which everybody hates, and a chorus that has the F word in it. We're trying to take that to radio. That makes no sense at all. And initially, everybody told him he was crazy. And now they've sold over 4 million records between their two records. And the other one is Dual Tone. You know, Lumineers. When people looked at the Lumineers, they said, are you kidding me? Like, the Suspenders, and there's not even any instruments in the band except for a kick drum, and, like, I think that guy has a triangle. And and their record's over 900,000 records right now. And so there are really despite all the doom and gloom, and there's a lot of that, there are some really cool things happening, and people are finding – whether you're a fan of those two bands or not, obviously there's a market for them. And a couple of years ago, there was not. Mm-hmm. And so people are finding a way in what is still largely a heavily funded and mainstream-driven economy, music economy, to get, you know, there's cracks in the armor. There's some really cool stories happening.
And the thing is that what you'll find is that most of the ones that are well-funded, you'll see those things happen within a three-month time period. The ones that Sterling's talking about, you'll see happen over a three-year time period.
Right.
The better news for his side of the story is that if something takes 3 years to get a big following behind it and ends up with a big following behind it, it tends to keep on going. All right? Something that happens and is a hit, I mean, a year from now, and this could be completely wrong because Psy may come up with another gimmick kind of thing to happen, but gimmicks usually run their course and then kind of fade in and you don't hear from the guy again. You know, that's what happens. When things are built and they're built on a solid fan base of fans liking the stuff, that artist has a better shot, in my estimation, of having a career than the artists that are built, you know, like the Kardashians, because they're thrown out there and everybody wants to see what's going to happen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stand up.
A little short, sorry.
And just a reminder, if you wouldn't mind, give us your name and maybe some idea of what brought you here.
Hi, I'm Teresa Samaras. I'm with the Joel A. Katz Music Entertainment Business Program, and I'm here thanks to Keith Barisi. My question is, with how hectic everything you guys are doing, and like you said, every day is different, do you really ever find stability? And especially as the years pass, does it ever become easier or less stressful?
For me, my answer is no. But you got to balance. I love what I do. For me, and this is just something about my personality, I have a very hard time being content. The other day, you know, got some good news about a campaign we've got going on with one of our clients, and I got home, my wife, you know, I think she wanted to crack out the champagne, and it was great. It was a nice victory, but with every victory, the next step becomes that much more crucial. So it's, as far as the stress goes, whether you're dealing with an indie or a big artist, there's always a lot at stake. And I say that, I mean, one of the things that I love about this job and about, musicians are not, if your career in music doesn't work out, you don't just go put in the resume at the bank or the grocery store. It's not like, or grab the tie, you know, it's, you're hardwired this way. It's in your blood. So you're dealing with people that, you know, it's not like, well, my position, you know, here at the bookstore isn't going to pan out. I'm sure there's something else to do. So to me, the stakes are always high because you're dealing with people that this is who they are. And I don't ever want to feel like that doesn't matter. And I get it's only rock and roll. I get it. It's not, you know, we're not curing cancer. So sometimes you have to step back and have a little perspective. But at the same time, the stakes are high. I want to succeed for, you know, the people we work with because it is what they are. It's who they are. I don't think it gets, you know, certain things in the daily routine get easier and become second nature and whatever. But I think that the pressure is always there, and I want it to be. It's part of what I love, and it's you know, I think if that went away, then I'd worry that I was losing passion for what I was doing.
Thank you.
I'm a slightly A-type personality, I think. So I'm always kind of on the edge of anything that I'm doing. But I've been really blessed with the people that I have in my office. It's been a fairly stable situation now for a fairly long time, and even before Sterling was there or before some of the other people that are there now, there was long periods of time where I had the same people around me, and I've been lucky that the people that I've put myself behind – that work in the office, I've been right. They have developed probably even past what I thought they would be able to do, and have grown how you want to see as someone running an office or someone that owns an office like I do, that you see the people progress, because that's one side of it for me is that would be disheartening is that if I put a lot of effort into somebody that was working in the office and they didn't turn out, that kind of bothers me because it makes me feel like I wasn't able to get them to understand. Sometimes it's just that they lose the, like Sterling says, he still has the passion for everything. When people lose the passion for this business, they usually lose it pretty fast. And then the other thing is that even artists that have kept me up all night long worrying about whether somebody was going to die during the middle of the night, because I did 14 years with Lynyrd Skynyrd, and you never knew when you were going to get a phone call that somebody was dead. And I got quite a few. I got more than my share of phone calls to tell me that somebody was dead. But even in those situations, most of the artists that we have represented, and especially the band Styx that we represent now, which is kind of like our flagship band in our office, they are extremely talented, and they are extremely driven, and they want things done the way they do. But they are the most gracious people that there are. And it's a lot easier to come to work and work really hard for people that appreciate it than it is for somebody that you come and work for. I don't care how much money they're paying you. At the end of the day, if you walk in there and you got to listen to them tell you how they're making you money or they're doing this or they're doing that, it gets old. I mean, especially when you get to be, over 50 or 60, which I am, it gets real old real fast, because I've been around, some of the greatest rock stars that have ever walked the face of the earth, and I haven't listened to shit from them, so I'm not going to start listening to it from guys that are 20 years old now.
Thank you.
Hi. I think it's just about my height. My name is Leanne Allen. I am a songwriter, but I'm actually here on behalf of my son and the new band that he's a part of, and they're trying to figure out their way into management, So I have two questions. One, you referred to earlier, you said somebody in management needs to know a little bit about all of the aspects of the business. So I wondered if you could list what all of the aspects of the business are. Or give me the top 10 or something like that.
It's probably changed a lot over the decades. I think it used to be records and touring and then maybe drug supply.
The type of drug, right?
This always sounds so obvious, and they got to be great at what they do. And the reality is there's a lot of really good stuff out there. There's not a lot of truly great stuff. And obviously that's subjective. But they've got to hone that first. The songs, the stage. But beyond that, they've got to put on the business hat. Social media in this day and age kind of goes without saying is vital. I think that artists have to. This sounds funny to say. Artists have to know who they are, and that sounds like kind of a stupid statement. But it's amazing how many don't know who they are, or don't know what they want to be, or where they want to go. And you've got to have a clear picture in your mind of what it is you want to achieve. Everybody has different definitions of success. Those definitions, your goals obviously can change as you go, but I think artists need to have a pretty clear vision of what they're all about as an artist, what it is they want to achieve. Over time, you have to learn who your audience is. That's another thing that a lot of people don't have a good grip on is who they're trying to reach and how to reach them, not things that just happen in the blink of an eye. There's... this day and age, knowing some graphic and web design can do a lot of good for you. Some video editing can do a lot of good for you. I'll never forget, you know, it was probably in 1998 or 99 when we started getting calls from people asking for high-res JPEGs, and we're like, what the hell are you talking about? And we used to have to outsource everything.
Like, I still say that.
Like, you need a photo cropped, and you got to outsource it. And now, of course, it's like all that stuff has to – we do it all the time. And so, you know, learning something about those things as an artist can do you a lot of good. Because without them, you're not going to have the kind of social media and online presence you need to have unless you're paying somebody to do it. Generally speaking, whether you're an artist or somebody trying to get into the business, I'm always a big proponent of learning as much. All the things you think you might never do in the business, learn something about them because you're going to need to know them. I constantly run into artists who maybe do – the other day, I've got a client who did a writing session with a guy who's been writing songs for a long time, and we actually put the song on a record. And I called him up, and I said, who's your PRO? And he said, what? And I said, you know, we want to pay your you know, we're going to owe you mechanicals on this record. Who do we pay? It's like, can you just make it out to me? And so these are things that that for a lot of people, honestly, that should be 101, and a lot of people have no idea. Publishing is a tricky. I mean, publishing is a world all its own, and it's not easy. You don't have to learn everything about publishing, but if you're going to be writing songs, learn the basics because that is you got to protect that stuff.
And if you're going to be representing people, you should know that end of the. You should know that part of it also, because you're going to have people that come in that don't know, and you got to be able to deal with it for them.
And if anybody's interested in publishing, next month we're doing a mock negotiation of a publishing deal, which doesn't deal with performance royalties, but it'll get you more than just the basics. Well, thanks.
Thank you.
I'm Jay Martin. A lot of people know me as well. I co-manage Tasha Couture with Rico Brooks. And I just really wanted to know, what would be the best way to go into a pub deal situation, and when you have a little weight to go in with it. But the thing is, especially with urban, you can get so many views and get so many mixtapes are out, you don't get paid for it. You get so many views on mixtape on YouTube, you don't get paid for it. You get little radio spins there, everybody knows who you are, but there's no pay coming in. So, but the person that wants to pick you up knows who you are. And you also have a Grammy winning songwriter, and you have a lot of weight behind you, but you actually haven't brought in a lot of money to the situation.
Let me ask you this: what's your goal with the publishing deal?
Really, to get a.
Are you looking for a cash advance?
No, not a big one. not a big cash advance. So you just really look for. Well, we're looking for good points.
I'll say that generally, as a general rule of thumb, I'm a huge proponent of keeping control of your own publishing, control your own publishing, control your own masters. Because down the road, I understand that right now you're seeing plays and streams and views and you're not getting paid for them, and you're certainly not alone in dealing with that right now. Down the road, if there is success on any kind of a big level and you don't own that publishing, that's a big chunk of change that you will not see.
Right.
There are reasons to make a pub deal. There are different kinds of pub deals, and actually it sounds like the next event that NARAP's doing might be a great one. There are co-pub deals. There's admin deals. There's different ways to structure them so that it still makes sense for you. Make sure you have a clear idea in your mind of why you want the publishing deal so that you're not giving up something that down the road you're going to wish you had back, because it can be people do that a lot, and it can turn into lots of money.
Because if you're making a publishing deal with someone that's going to offer you money as an advance, they already have their plan for what they're going to do with your publishing and what they're going to do with the money that they make from your publishing.
Right.
So you've got to try and get yourself on the same level that they are. And unless, I mean, with us, just like Sterling's saying, with us, with most of our artists, we'll go and look for any other way to get them income if they need income to pay for stuff. I mean, we did with one of our artists, we did a Kickstarter campaign that Sterling did and got enough money to do a video. Now, when we did that, we didn't lose anything getting that video done. That video is now on CMT. It's doing very, very well. If we would have done it as an advance on a publishing deal, anything that came off of that became publishing money, they're going to get the money, not us. So we try and keep our artists to hold on to that and hold on to it for as long as you can, because anybody that's a reputable publisher that's got the money, if they're going to give you an advance, they have an idea of how they're going to get their money back. They're not today's publishers are very savvy people.
Right, and the thing is, we want to work out a real good percent where we won't, you know, we don't really want a big advance. But
those kind of deals will come when you've amassed enough stuff that they want you, and then you can say, I don't care about the advance, give me this or give me that, but this is what I want. And then, like Sterling saying, you could work out an ad man deal. The deal is, though, is that if in a lot of situations, publishers have been the people that have helped with radio campaigns, have helped. They have people on staff. When you're talking about big publishing companies, they have people on staff that actually do stuff to help anything that's happening. All right? They're not great companies in my estimation, and this is just my opinion. Somebody else could have a different opinion. But they're not great companies when it comes to breaking an unknown artist, because they have an unknown quantity and they have music that nobody's ever heard. If you've got stuff happening with the thing, they'll come looking for you.
Right, and like I said, it's a Grammy-winning songwriter. So mm-hmm. Now the thing is that we just don't want to get in a deal where we'd be like, later on down the line, you'll be like, okay, maybe we shouldn't have done
right.
that, but you're already stuck. So
right.
Well, I'm just trying to find
and those publishing deals last a long time, believe me.
All right. Yeah.
My best advice for you is to get a good attorney.
Right.
How y'all doing? My name is Jordash McCray. I go by Low. That's Low. No relationship. Just all right. I'm actually a recent graduate from Alabama State University, and I have a degree in communications with an emphasis in recording industry. And my question is, as far as looking from a management standpoint, do you feel knowledge outweighs relationships or vice versa when it comes to breaking into the industry in a management position?
In both breaking into an industry and staying into an industry, this is an industry of relationships.
Yeah.
This has been an industry of relationships since it started. It's all about who you know and how you know and who will take your calls and who won't take your calls. Mm-hmm. And that's, I mean, at least that's what it's been like for me.
I think there's a lot of people in this business with a lot of relationships and no knowledge of anything.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
But they have the relationships.
Yeah.
I got the relationships. Knowledge I'll find somewhere else.
All right, cool.
Hi, my name's Melissa Young. I'm a singer-songwriter, and I'm approaching managing another artist. Question, I recently started dealing with the idea of a contract for the artist, and I'm not very familiar with if the management contract should and should not include any part of publishing if I'm not writing with the artist. And I was just wondering how you guys approach that, because the entertainment lawyer that I have, she's on my side, but at the same time she said, you know, they really nowadays try and stay away from doing management contracts that, you know, cover any of the publishing with the artist unless you're writing with the artist. And I was just curious if that's, you know, standard or new.
We have a very unorthodox way of dealing with management client contracts. We shake hands with our artist. I haven't had a management agreement with an artist, and I have no idea how long, because I found out at a very, very young age that any management agreement that is written up, that if the artist does not want to have you be their manager, they will find a way out of that contract. They will either buy their way out, they'll get somebody else to assume it, they'll get indemnified by somebody. But when you don't have a relationship any longer with an artist and it's only held together by what's written, you'll get what's coming to you out of what's written, and that's all you'll get, and you'll never speak to that artist again. The fourth time that I was fired by Lynyrd Skynyrd, I had put together the biggest tour that they were ever have, that they probably still to this day did when they went out with them and ZZ Top together. I did not have a contract with that band. They could have just walked out and left it. And I got a call from Gary Rossington, who told me, call our accountant, tell him how much we owe you from this tour, and we'll pay you. And we got paid every dime that we had coming from that tour. That was based on a relationship. That wasn't based on a contract. If I would have had a contract, I would have probably spent $100,000 in legal fees to get the attorneys and the accountants to work the deal out, and everything like that was worked out on a phone call.
I'll say that I've got an agreement with an artist that I don't touch publishing. Of course, he hadn't earned anything yet, so it doesn't really matter. But don't touch publishing. We'll commission royalties on record sales if he ever sells any. And I think you already kind of said this, but any agreement you do as far as the writing, as co-writing goes, should be a completely separate agreement.
Absolutely.
That should be a songwriter agreement and kept
that's,
totally clear.
That's really getting into, you know, that's not a management relationship. And that being said, I mean, you know, Peter Asher managed James Taylor and they wrote songs together, but they had a separate publishing agreement that handled all of that stuff. And you don't want – one of the things that you got to be careful about if you are dealing with contracts with artists is that the least amount of paper that it can be put on and the more concise that it can be and spell out what the relationship is, that's what's important, because all the other stuff is just stuff for attorneys to run up bills.
Now, as a follow-up to that, if an artist is self-published or has a co-pub or an admin deal, would you, as the manager, consider taking commission of that as opposed to the songwriter royalties?
I have not.
I have a number of times, and it's an individual situation. If you're doing something to further the publishing deal, if you're negotiating the deal for them, if you're, you know, then you know. But you know, let's say tomorrow I started representing John Bon Jovi, there would never be a conversation that would take place about getting paid on his publishing for all his songs that he's written, that he's getting paid, you know, whatever he's getting paid on every year, because that's a flow of money that just continues and continues.
Cool. All right, who's next?
Okay. Morris Roberts here. I'm an entertainment agent, and I just recently got into management. I've been into it for number of years, but anyway, what can you do nowadays to keep an artist busy when you're trying to get their music to the level of mainstream? And most clubs have DJs, and they don't do bands, and they don't do groups anymore, and you call them about booking your artist. If the artist's not on the radio, then they don't want to buy the act. So what can you do in addition to?
It's part of what one of the major problems that we have today. Acts used to be able to be built by playing live performances in clubs. There are a limited amount of places that can do that. But I believe, and I mean, if you have an artist, you know, it takes a little bit more work, but on a grassroots level, if you're working on an artist or anything like that, Sterling had alluded earlier to the idea of, If you live in Atlanta, you break Atlanta first, and then you move out, and you keep on making the circle bigger, which is something that I've always believed in. You can go. I believe a lot of times you can go and find certain clubs where you can go to the club owner and go, listen, I've got somebody here who, if you give them a chance and they come in, they'll bring people into your club, because that's what club owners want. And you'll find ones that'll, you know, you find the one that believes that you can do the same thing and that they'll give it a shot. It's few and far between. I mean, we've got a couple of young up and coming artists, and one of the biggest problems, what it is finding places for them to play. That's just you know, they're disappearing.
Like back in the day, we used to book a band in a club for like Thursday, Friday, Saturday, sure, Sunday. But sure, Nowadays it's like one nighters.
Right.
So nobody want to really take a chance on them. So
there used to be four clubs that you had to choose for a rock band in Atlanta. There used to be four clubs that you had to choose from. You could play the clubs against each other. All those clubs are gone.
So what do you do, internet? What do you do nowadays?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's so many different. I think it's tough to say without knowing more about the specific artist. But there's so many things. There's so many different kind of parts of a career that have to be developed. Lately it's funny you bring this up. I had a client call me this morning and say, "I got some time on my hands today. What do you want me doing?" Which is a rare thing to hear. But and I said, "Well." And in this particular artist's case, where there are, as regulations change in Georgia, craft breweries and micro distilleries are popping up all over the place in Georgia, because the laws are finally loosening up enough that it makes sense to brew in the state of Georgia. Well, alcohol and music are a great fit. And, you know, we've been looking for a small amount of – we're looking for people who are willing to invest some money in this band who is at a level – not at a level where you can go after a Jack Daniels or a – Budweiser, but you find a startup who's got a craft brew who maybe has a little bit of money to spend in marketing and wants to spread the word on the product. So I said to him, I said, hit Google, and let's work on this list. We got about 20 of them right now that we're targeting, and let's grow it. And sure enough, by the end of the day, we had, I think it was like 46 between micro distilleries and craft breweries. I'm not telling you to go tell your artists to go sit on Google all day. My point, though, is that there are, so in that case, it's seeking funding. And that also gets into the branding conversation of aligning ourselves with a certain brand. There's always, social media has to sort of be regulated. You don't want to beat people to death. But if you're using, there's generally plenty of work to be done in terms of engaging fan base on social media if the artist has a fan base, an established fan base. So really on the club thing too, I mean, there are still clubs out there. It is so competitive. You got to dig. And I can tell you stories about those rare occasions where we found the right buyer at a club who suddenly became a fan and started to champion a story. And that's like the spark that led to a bigger fire, and things just kind of grew. And so we're always, I've spent a lot of time with acts that don't have agents trying to book them. Which is not really my job, but when you work with a young act who doesn't have an agent and the job has to get done, and it's brutal. I mean, it's brutal. But you dig and you dig and you dig and you look for that spark. And if the act's, I don't want to paint a Disney story here. It's not as simple as saying if the act's good enough, it will happen, because that's not necessarily the case. But you gotta, I'm not afraid to tell my artist. If you're worried about what your April calendar is looking like, I'm trying to do 400 other things for you. Get on the phone, because frankly, a lot of those clubs love to have a relationship with an artist. Mm-hmm. They don't want to talk to a manager,
right.
Especially at a level. It's different when you reach a certain level and you're bringing in big money. But at a, there are definitely talent buyers out there who want the relationship with your artist because they think it's cool. So tell your artist to get on the phone, and start making the calls.
Okay, thank you.
I hate to cut it off, but we're down to the last few minutes. So if anybody else has any questions, maybe you guys could. I'm going to have our guests give some parting remarks, any advice you might want to give these folks. And then if anybody does have any questions, if you'd like to give some way that they might be able to contact you, Twitter at the very least or something like that. And then anything that you wanted to say but you didn't get a chance, let's hear it.
I could go for hours on some of my favorite topics. I don't know the parting words. I'd say that as much as this is a scary time in this business, it's an exciting time, and I do think it is going to get worse before it gets better. But I think for anybody on the artist side or the business side, we got to weather the storm. It's as simple as that. And it's a cliche, but during periods like this, there's a lot of opportunity out there. I think that, you know, like I said earlier, I think the single biggest challenge we face is learning how to work with an artist to develop a real fan base, people who develop a trust with a fan base. You know, we call them super fans a lot, to develop that group of super fans that is going to stick with you. And I think that there are some really cool ways to do that. There's some really cool things. We didn't really touch on, like, what's going on in EDM tonight. I'm not necessarily a fan of that music, but I'm a huge fan of what's happening, because to me, it takes me back to my days as a kid trading mixtapes with friends. And then in college, when we'd sit around on a Friday night with stacks of CDs, and the whole idea was, sitting there with music buffs, what can I turn you on to? What can I play you that you're going to think is cool? And there was a sense of community about it. And I remember, so if one of my buddies who I knew had a good ear played me something that I loved, then I'm in. I'm hooked. And I think it's a matter of trying to recreate that in this day and age. And I think that's to a large degree what has happened in EDM, which I think is incredibly cool. It is music that has this thriving community in kind of an underground sense. And I think that what we all, in my opinion, as a business, we have to look at what has happened in that, you know, call it a movement if you want, and understand why it's happening to a degree. And there's a lot of lessons there. And I think that and you see that with a lot of niche music, not just EDM. You see it with a lot of the niche stuff. And I think, because I think there's a coolness to being in a club that is not mainstream. I think it's a tough time in this business, but it's an exciting time too. And there are better days ahead, and they may not be tomorrow, and they may not be next week, but they're coming. It may get ugly before we get there. But I think it's, look at it this way. This is, from a fan's perspective, this is the golden age. Music has never been consumed as much as it is being consumed right now. It's not being paid for, but it has never been consumed the way it is being right now. And think about all the different ways that every day we all come into contact somehow with music. It's a long list. It's no longer just the radio and MTV or the stage. And I think that's important, because I think that as a business, we have to know that the consumption of music, it's always going to be there. There's always going to be a need for that. And so we've got to weather this storm, learn to create a true sense of value and trust between an audience and an artist. And then if we can do that, we'll figure out how to monetize it.
The fact that all of you people are here just is a testament to the fact that there still is young people that want to get involved in the business and that are interested in the business and everything like that. The one thing that I would have you go away with is to know that if you're looking for a job, if you're looking for something that's got steady pay and all of that, you're better, and you want to be in the entertainment business, my suggestion would be to get a law degree or to get a degree in accounting, because there's all kinds of paying jobs in those two areas that are on the fringe of music or involved in music or involved in the entertainment business. But just like your artist, you're going to have to scrape and fight and be as entrepreneurial as you can possibly be to even have a chance in this business. But I've seen that people that are dedicated and that want it and that go after it, they somehow find a way to get that door open. I did. I mean, I just wouldn't go away. When I was in college, when they would tell me, go do this, I'd go do it. Whatever it was that they wanted done in the office, because I was trying to learn everything that was going on in that office. And quite frankly, those 4 years while I was going to college, I learned enough that when I went to Tampa and I signed that band, I figured out what to do with them, and I knew different ways to get the different people. I seeded the thing to get Clive Davis and interested in the band. You just do whatever you've got to do. You've also got to be able to take your victories and your defeats with each other and not let either of them get you either too high or too low. And you've got to also remember that if you're going in the direction that Wiv went, you have to represent the artist. And the one thing that you've got to be able to keep in this business, you don't have to have integrity with anybody that you deal with except for your artist. I've done everything that I've had to do to somebody in the name of my artist. I don't really care what anybody else in the business thinks of me. The only thing that I give a shit about is what my artists think. And that's the bottom line, because that's who I work for. Everybody else, that doesn't matter. It matters what the guys that I represent or the girls that I represent, it matters what they think at the end of the day.
Well, if you guys enjoyed tonight's conversation, we do this once a month, and we encourage you to come back. We're going to have new panelists, new topics, but for now, I would ask you guys, please give these two fine gentlemen a round of applause.
Thanks for having us.
All right, everybody have a good evening.
Thank you for listening. Join NARIP now and come to an event near you. NARIP. Get connected. Stay connected.